Hello and welcome back to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. My name is Simon Brew from Film Stories magazine, and this is a regular podcast celebrating one of the biggest and deepest film libraries in the world. Studio Canal's extensive catalogue of films brings together cinema from around the globe, going back well over a century. The full library is over 6,000 titles strong, with all-time classics like Ran and Peeping Tom, filmmaking documentaries such as Milius and Becoming Bond, and awards attractors including Leaving Las Vegas and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. And we're going to do our very best to explore it all in this podcast. Now, across the last few months, we've explored The French New Wave, Apocalypse Now, the glorious work of John Carpenter. Now, though, well, it's time to fasten your seatbelts as we're stepping behind the wheel of The Driver, the hugely influential lean 1978 movie that's coming to 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray for the first time. Now, Arjun Sajeep is joining me to talk about this one. He's currently the reviews editor at Sight and Sound. He's written features on film for BBC Culture, CinemaScope, Cineast and Little White Lies. And he's also sipping a delicious coffee that I've just bought him from over the road. So while he lets the caffeine work its magic on him, let's rev things up with a clip from The Driver.
You've been set up, you know.
By a cop.
That's right. He's waiting for you right now at the wrong place. Me and my friend don't want to show up. You two hotshots have both been set up, haven't you? You know what always amazed me about you? A guy with your attitude never carries a gun? That's stupid. Very stupid.
So, Arjun, can you set this film up for us? Can you introduce The Driver?
Sure. So, The Driver is a movie from 1978. It's got an incredibly simple premise.
Okay.
A getaway driver, played by Ryan O'Neill at peak handsomeness, is pursued through the streets of LA, mostly at night, by a crooked detective, played by Bruce Dern. And this is a real taut kind of gem of a film. It's 87 minutes, incredibly tight.
Oh, I like it already. Yeah.
Yep. You've heard of tight 90, this is tight 87.
Okay.
It's structured around three amazing car chases, and it's an important entry in the filmography of Walter Hill, who today is probably best known for his youth gang drama The Warriors, his buddy cop movie 48 Hours, and for Arnie fans, Red Heat.
Of course.
He also co-produced the Alien movies.
Yes, but let's focus on that opening sequence in Red Heat, nonetheless.
Crazy.
Yes, it's a bit bad, right?
I mean, yeah, it's 80s Arnie. It's
incredibly 80s. That's the one with James Belushi
as well,
isn't it?
Yeah.
And so in the context of The Driver, you mentioned there that this was Walter Hill early in his career. Can you put that into some kind of chronological context for us?
Yeah. So this was Walter Hill's second film. His first film was Hard Times, about a bare-knuckled boxer and his manager during the Great Depression. And that wasn't, I wouldn't say a great film, but it is a good film. And quite plainly, it's a gorgeous film to look at. And you hear a lot of people today, you know, sort of film commentators, especially on Twitter, complaining about how these days no one knows how to light a movie anymore. And, you know, lighting and composition are sort of these skills that have fallen by the wayside. And a good way of like measuring it against films of yesteryear is not to look at the great masterpieces of the 70s, but to just look at like a fairly average film like Hard Times, which just looks so beautiful. And Hill and his cinematographer, Philip Lathrop, who would then go on to shoot The Driver, did a great job there. Fun fact about Philip Lathrop. So as well as doing Hard Times and The Driver, one of his great contributions to movie history was as a camera operator on Touch of Evil, you know, that classic opening scene. He didn't do the cinematography. That was Russell Metty, but Metty was always very kind of, if you pardon the pun, meticulous.
Very good.
About giving credit to Philip Lathrop for the smoothness with which he operates that camera in the opening scene of Touch of Evil. Anyway, so that was Hard Times. And at this point, Hill was still best known as a screenwriter. He had written The Getaway, a Sam Peckinpah film. And you'd see quite a few things in common with The Driver. You've got this kind of laconic masculinity, this lead that's kind of capable of violence but isn't generally given to asserting it unless necessary. And Hill had written a bunch of other stuff as well, but most of it had been sort of taken on by other directors who had tinkered with it, and Hill wasn't super satisfied with all of that. So he'd also worked as second unit director on Bullet, a Steve McQueen movie, which is a film with car chases, obviously makes you think.
That's
well,
some
the
degree
is
of understatement, isn't it?
Exactly. For gearheads, it is truly a trip. but although Bullet is sort of, you know, makes sense in that Walter Hill chronology, He was also second unit director on Take the Money and Run by Woody Allen.
Oh, okay.
But I think the way it sort of influenced Hill was that Woody Allen, obviously being a writer-director, I think Hill got the impression that if a director had written the screenplay as well, all the actors and everyone would have sort of more respect for the screenplay. And so he was like, this is good, this is encouraging.
And so to a degree, the driver was a product of frustration with his previous film experiences.
To some extent. I mean, he had done Hard Times, which is something he co-wrote and directed. And I think he generally had quite a good experience with Hard Times. There wasn't too much kind of studio interference. He got on pretty well with Charles Bronson, which not everyone can say they have.
Yep.
He didn't get on so well with James Coburn. But that's a different story.
Well, Charles Bronson was linked with The Driver, wasn't he?
He was, exactly. So The Driver had a few different people in the lineup for the main role of The Driver, the eponymous role. And it's worth pointing out that the character doesn't have a name in the film. He's just The Driver. The detective that pursues him is just The Detective. You know, the characters are just named The Something.
Well, I like to think if we didn't have The Driver, we'd have never had the mighty Kevin Costner in Waterworld as the Mariner.
Could be.
That's a clear cinematic through path to there, I think.
Well, I think for Hill, this was in one of his interviews, he says, when you walk out of a movie, often you just refer to the actor's name. When you're talking about who did what, you're like, oh, you know, when Steve McQueen walked into the bar or whatever, you never use the character's name. If everyone just talks about the characters using the actor's name, why bother naming the characters at all? Let's just, you know, let's just name them The Driver or whatever, and then that makes it much easier. And that's kind of like the ethos of the film, to strip everything back completely. So it's purely just cogs and gears kind of thing.
And so Bronson was one of those who was linked with playing The Driver, but I thought there was some fallout on Hill's previous movie that kind of dissuaded him from taking it on.
Yeah, exactly. So I think Steve McQueen might have been the first choice for the studio anyway. But Steve McQueen had done enough car movies for Steve McQueen.
Yes.
He was like, I don't want to be typecast. I'm not sure how much he succeeded in not being typecast, but there you go. That was his intention anyway. And then Charles Bronson was someone that Hill was like, oh, this would be good. And we got on well during the filming of Hard Times. But I think Bronson was a bit miffed that in the edit, his wife, Jill Ireland, who was also acting in Hard Times, had her role sort of minimized. He didn't take too kindly to that. I don't think it was like a really, you know, nuclear falling out. I think it was just Bronson being a bit unpredictable.
My favourite Charles Bronson story relates to 1991 City Slickers, where he was offered the role that Jack Palance played.
Uh-huh.
He read the script, was interested in doing it, and then what happens to the character in that film is a malt spoiler, and Bronson apparently rang up and said, there's no way I'm taking this film at all, not with what happens to that character. He was insulted at being asked. Jack Palance takes it on and promptly wins an Oscar for it. Perfect Charles Bronson, I think.
Yeah, it's always interesting to think about how these films with these iconic characters would just be so different.
How'd the new girl work out?
She did her job.
Who'd you have pay her off?
I did it myself.
You said as well that Ryan O'Neill came to the film. I think your phrase was peak handsomeness, was it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, where in his career was it? Was it quite a coup to get someone like Ryan O'Neill to this?
Yeah, I think O'Neill was probably interested in something very different to what he'd already been doing. I mean, I'm not even sure where he was on the list of choices. I'm not even sure he was fourth choice.
Yeah.
Someone that we haven't mentioned who was in the contention for The Role of the Driver was Sylvester Stallone.
Amazing.
Which also would have been a very, you know, very different film.
He did do a film called Driven in the end as well.
I wonder
if that was like his little tribute to that.
Could have been.
Yeah.
I think none of them would have been anywhere near as good as O'Neill.
Yeah.
And he was doing something quite new to what he'd been doing before. Obviously, he was known for films like Love Story.
Yep.
He'd played sort of scoundrels in Paper Moon and Barry Lyndon. He'd been in comedies like What's Up, Doc? He wasn't playing anyone quite so streamlined as a character, with no embellishments, no sort of eccentricities, not your typical romantic lead.
Why am I here?
Some people want to meet. They're from downtown. We've done a few jobs.
Shooters.
Yeah.
I told you I don't like guns.
I know, but they're looking to move up. They got their eyes set on something special.
They know my price.
Everybody knows your price.
In a way, this is quite refreshing because I think there were scenes filmed with him and Isabella Gianni, who plays like the female lead, kissing, but they didn't make it into the final cut, and I think that's good.
I'd be fascinated to see the pitch for this that goes to an actor. It's just like, I mean, if we go with the general convention that one page of screenplay is 1 minute of screen time, barely any dialogue in it, is there? So I'd imagine a pamphlet gets delivered to their door.
Yeah.
Your character's not going to have a name, not going to speak for most of it. Fancy signing on the dotted line.
Yeah. I haven't counted the words in the film, but I think the total of words that he speaks is 350.
Yes.
Even Bruce Dern, who sort of, as his character, plays second fiddle, has a lot more dialogue than he does.
Maybe we are alike.
No.
When I lose, I just go broke. You go to jail.
You mentioned Isabella Gianni. Where did she come into this film? How was she attracted to it? And is it true she wasn't particularly happy with the end result?
So in the film, she essentially plays a sort of cipher. She plays a character called The Player, who's sort of paid off to be an alibi for the driver. The role was actually not written with Ajani in mind. It was written with Tuesday Weld in mind. And Weld would go on to star in Michael Mann's Thief, a film that actually owes quite a lot, I think, to the driver, particularly in the kind of nighttime scenes. And she came on board because the film was co-produced by EMI. So 20th Century Fox had sort of said, OK, we'll take this on, but we're not really willing to finance it fully, so we'd like to partner up. So EMI took distribution rights for the rest of the world, not the US, and Fox had distribution rights for the US. And one of the conditions for EMI was that they would have a European actor in it. And so that's how Isabella Gianni came on board. Her star was kind of in the ascendant at this point. She'd just done the story of Adele H for Francois Truffaut, and I think she was nominated for an Oscar for that one.
Yeah.
She was a promising name, certainly someone that I think people were expecting to do things in Hollywood, not just in France. And so there was lots of transatlantic correspondence between Hill and Ajani. Everything was obviously much slower then. You can just jump on a Zoom call. Hill eventually flew to Paris to meet her, and I think that went well. He ended up being pretty happy with her performance. I think he described her a couple of times in interviews as Garbo-esque.
Yeah.
And I think that's really quite apposite because you can sort of imagine her almost speaking with no dialogue.
Put the key in a safe deposit box for 6 months. Then go get the money.
I'm on a streak. I'm going to play it out. I'm going to get it tonight.
I know all about streaks. Every player says this time is different.
Was she happy with it in the end?
Well, in the short term, I think she did have a really happy experience with it. She'd liked Hard Times, which is why she wanted to come on board and work with Hill. She had a lot of respect for Hill. And I think she said in interviews around the time shortly after that she was quite happy. She didn't have to, quote unquote, dig deep for the part, which is so interesting because that's not, you know, that digging deep is something we very much associate with Ajani. She's always dug pretty deep, or often dug very, very deep for some incredible performances. But here, I think she found it quite restful, is another word she used to describe it. But I think later, because the film bombed in America, I think she came to think, you know, what if I hadn't taken on the driver? Maybe I could have had a different career in the US. Maybe I could have become a bigger star there.
The lead trio is completed here by Bruce Dern, who was someone who went into this aware that there wasn't a lot of dialogue to work with. He's also not a very likable character.
Now, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to catch the cowboy that's never been caught. Cowboy Desperado.
So he plays a scumbag detective. It's sort of reflective of what Hill would, you know, had already done in Hard Times and would go on to do in some of his subsequent films, which is basically having two male leads, one very laconic and strong silent type, and the other always running his mouth off, couldn't keep his trap shut kind of thing. So Hard Times had this where you've got Charles Bronson as obviously the strong silent type, and then James Coburn as the guy that whose mouth always gets them into trouble, puts them in sticky situations. And 48 Hours had this too. You've got Nick Nolte, you've got Eddie Murphy. You can probably guess who the talkative one is of the two. So in The Driver, Dern is very much the talkative one. I think he'd already been given some fairly wordy dialogue, but then he went on to embellish it further, which makes him really annoying in the film. But like, that's what you want. His character is meant to be really annoying. He thinks he has all the answers. And there's this weird relationship he has with this other cop where you're not quite sure what the dynamic is in terms of who's superior to who. It seems like he should be answerable to the guy that he's always talking down to, but he's nonetheless always talking down to him, and so it's like, who's managing who?
Tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to help you be a better cop. You know how? You know what you do first thing every morning? Read the sports page. You know why? Best part of the newspaper. Winners, losers, how it happened, score. Now, we got a much better game than one they give the players. They don't retire us after 10 years.
Do you think it's obvious where our sympathies are being led as an audience with this?
Yeah, more or less. And I think that's really just down to O'Neill's performance.
Yeah.
He's entirely responsible for the film's soul and soulfulness. Your sympathies are entirely with him. And Dern, because he plays unlikable so well. And sleazy so well that you just think, oh, God.
He plays obsessive so well.
He does,
as well in this. I do wonder if there's a little degree of homoeroticism to it, if it all goes a little bit Point Break on us.
That's interesting. I guess if so, it's much less obvious than in many other films like Point
Break. Point Break.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not sure.
It's a double bill though, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, I would love. The Driver would be a worthy double bill entry. So many double bills, so many things you could program it with. And it's 87 minutes.
We talked there about characters not having names, but if I got this right, Los Angeles, I don't remember Los Angeles being named in the film either. I just wonder, where does this film, in your view, sit in the pantheon of classic LA movies?
I think it's definitely a really distinctive entry. The streets of LA, the nighttime streets of LA were really, I don't think they'd ever been captured like that before. And so in terms of, I guess, the pantheon of LA movies, this was the first film to really capitalize on what LA looked like at night, and especially with, you know, all these streets and these characters that operate entirely at night and chasing each other around in these quite elaborate chase sequences.
So it's for that reason, it's not a tourist board film, is it?
It's not a tourist board film. No, you don't look at that film and think, wow, that looks like a really cool place, a safe place to walk around at night.
I mean, I've read a couple of essays that suggest that there's no film that makes Los Angeles look as down and dirty as The Driver. Do you think there's something to that?
Well, I'm not sure, because it's also quite underpopulated. I mean, there's not many people, especially in the nighttime sequences.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that's one of the sort of logistically sensible decisions of setting it at night, means that there are fewer people around, because you do have to close off real areas and all that kind of thing. A lot of the time the film feels less populated than certain other films, either set in LA or other kind of crime films with car chase sequences. I mean, think about like The French Connection, for example.
Yeah.
You've got so many people and so many kind of moving parts in the chase sequence in New York.
I think also William Friedkin in his memoir admitted that they might have pushed the envelope of the law quite a lot when shooting The French Connection. I think that's probably about as far as I can say on this podcast. But when it came to the sequences here, you've hinted at the driving sequences. The physicality of those is really quite something. And there's one sequence in the movie in particular where they're just driving along a busy road and a part of a car just flies off. And this was all done for real.
Yeah, I mean, there were stuntmen, of course. But yeah, the scenes were very much real. Ryan O'Neill had been trained to do some of the stunts himself. You know, that final scene with the Chevrolet driving against the Trans Am. So you've got the Chevrolet, the Chevy pickup truck that's chasing this kind of cool Firebird-type car. They had to get it right first time because they only had one shot at this.
Yeah.
And Billy Burton was the stuntman on this. He'd done motorcycle stunts on Game of Death with Bruce Lee. He'd go on to do stunts in Heaven's Gate, in Predator, and perhaps most perilously of all, in American Pie 2. So Billy Burton had a roll cage and he had a harness. But it was still, it's pretty scary to watch that and thinking there was someone very much really inside that car, flying up this ramp, ending up upside down. And this kind of thing would happen, I think, more frequently in films from that of that vintage than it would today.
You said that they only had one chance to get some of these key stunts right. But the story goes still that even though Walter Hill knew his way around a car chase, he still couldn't quite get all the footage that he wanted.
I guess you could say he knew his way around a car chase. To some extent he did. He had some familiarity being on the shoot for car chases, but not super firsthand. He wasn't the cinematographer on Bullet. And so all the car chases, I think, were mostly worked out between Peter Yates, the director, Steve McQueen, and William Fraker, who was the cinematographer on that movie. So I think doing these chase scenes was probably a relatively new experience for him, especially on a scale like this, at night as well. And shooting at night was, I think, probably pretty important in securing just the sheer scope of the chases that take place. But I think, nonetheless, he really expanded the vocabulary of the car chase with these kind of sequences. In terms of, you know, whether everything came off the way he wanted to. So there are three chases in the movie, and for the first one, that was the one where he thought it didn't turn out quite like he wanted, because during filming there was an electrician that fell off a roof and had to be hospitalized. And so, you know, that kind of took everyone's attention away from shooting, and obviously that sort of diverted some resources. And so what essentially happened was that it was cobbled together in the edit. There was some of it that was shot, but the final stunt didn't quite come off the way Hill had planned, so it was sort of put together. But I actually think, especially in the first chase, the editing just feels so visceral.
Yeah.
And I think it's a question of necessity being the mother of invention. In this case, you had to kind of be quite creative with your editing to create the sense of an actual, you know, a car chase really happening. Maybe it would have even been less effective with the stunt. Maybe the editing would have been quite different. Maybe it would have ended up with, you know, a great slap bang stunt, but not quite the amazing bravura editing that you see in the finished product.
The leanness of the whole film, the fact that it was working to such boundaries and such resources, does ultimately play in its favour, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. You can really sense it in watching the film, because there are other films that have done car chases subsequently, films very much influenced by The Driver, that have much bigger budgets. And I think ultimately they're less effective. They have a less kind of thrilling effect on the viewer, particularly the car chases themselves, despite those films often being very much centered around the concept of car chases.
I like to think if Walter Hill did a Fast and Furious film, he would just come in and do it for $2 million. He'd just like poke a couple of cameras in the back of a couple of like Ford Capris or something.
I'm sure the world would be better for it.
Well, it would, wouldn't it? You talk about the three key driving sequences in the film. Do you have a favourite? What's your desert island driving sequence from The Driver?
I'm not sure I have one, you know. I think they're all great. They're all distinctive. They all do something different. They all have a different function in the film. The last one is quite distinctive because it's all taking place in this warehouse and it feels very much like Cat and Mouse.
Yeah.
It's about as cat and mouse as you can make a car chase, really. And then it ends with this amazing game of chicken, which necessitated that stunt, yeah. Billy Burton stunt that kind of made him go up, fly up this ramp and then turn the car upside down. So that is wonderful in its own way, but also just the first scene to start a film pretty much in that way. I mean, it's not literally the first scene, but it's very early in the film. That is just...
It front loads its intentions,
exactly.
Doesn't it? And so you said that the film wasn't a box office success on its initial release. And what was that initial response to The Driver like?
Mixed, decidedly mixed. Commercially, it didn't do well in the US. It wasn't regarded, I don't think, as a huge bomb because I don't think it was like that expensive a film to make. And also Fox had gone 50-50 on the costs with EMI. Yeah. But in Europe, the film did pretty well. And I think Hill has said, I don't know how accurate this is, but I think by his reckoning, in Japan alone, the film made back like half its budget or the EMI portion of the budget. So yeah, I think geographically, the response to the film commercially was very much split. As for critically, it was quite, I'm not sure too much about the European reviews, but in America, it was savaged. Vincent Canby, it's worth quoting him. I've got a note of what he said here. It is awful movie. It is pretentious movie. It is silly movie. It talks just like this. And I think, I mean, part of it feels like he's sort of missing the point.
Four stars, right?
Yeah. Well, I think it's so interesting that a film that is, and when I was watching the film or rewatching the film, I was sort of doing some calculations measuring how long the car chases were. And this film is literally almost 20% car chase.
Interesting.
And it's just amazing that a film that is almost 20% car chase can be described as pretentious by anyone.
Yeah.
I mean, I assume, you know, by pretentious he just meant it was very European in its sensibilities. It, you know, it had all these characters with no names. Oh, clearly Hill is striving for some deep meaning, but it doesn't really come off, and it's all you end up with is cliches. But actually, Hill was just making very streamlined entertainment.
Sometimes we do talk about films that are loved by filmmakers but never got the audience that they deserved. And, and The Driver now, as we talk about it now, has a great big long list of admirers.
Mm.
But is this a case where filmmakers love it more than audiences, do you think? Or do you think they've all finally come together?
Well, certainly for among audiences, you're finding more and more love for this film. And I think part of that is just, you know, the internet bringing people together, people recommending certain films, certain gems from the past. And this happens with a lot of films. One insightful review from the time was by Duncan Shepard of the San Diego Reader, and he gave it 5 stars. He said it was like a coded message passed from the movie maker to the devotees of the genre, in full view of, but beyond the full understanding of, the rest of the audience. And I think that's a really interesting way of looking at the film. It sort of undersells how entertaining the film is, but it does touch on the kind of nerves that the film itself is touching.
Yeah.
It sort of reminds me a bit of that Brian Eno quote about Velvet Underground and Nico, where only 30,000 people bought the record, but everyone that did formed a band. You know, it's
right,
this
okay.
kind of like, it's proved such an inspiration for the likes of Tarantino, for Michael Mann. Thief is clearly influenced by The Driver and some of the nighttime sequences, but also Drive, of course, by Nicholas Winding Refn.
Yes.
And Baby Driver by Edgar Wright. I mean, the chase sequences in those films are far less visceral for me. To be fair, that's not necessarily a knock on, say, Baby Driver, which was intended sort of more like a musical. Like it's all synced up with musical sequences, and so all the editing is done to that rather than to necessarily provide suspense. It's all to provide a sort of different kind of thrill to the audience. But Drive, meanwhile, is perhaps a fairer comparison. And like rewatching some of Drive's chase sequences, first of all, they're much shorter.
Yeah.
Second of all, the editing is much less exciting. And there are some like weirdly obvious and quite distracting continuity errors. And so the whole thing just feels, even though it came so much after and should have been, you know, you'd think perhaps more sophisticated, I just don't think the chase sequences or the driving sequences hold up anywhere near as well, you know, in Drive as they do in The Driver. But nonetheless, the Driver, back to the original point, was incredibly influential and perhaps more loved by genre aficionados and future film directors than by audiences.
I watched Drive before The Driver.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I came to watch The Driver, some films pay homage.
Mm.
Some films I just thought I'm getting deja vu.
Yeah.
Appreciating that they're both independent beasts in their own way.
Mm.
It does lean really quite close to it, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. And another reason I prefer The Driver, not just the chase sequences, but I think Ryan O'Neill, I would take one Ryan over the other.
I suppose there are the less obvious influences as well. I mean, you look at any... I touched on Fast and Furious films. Grand Theft Auto video games, mm-hmm. even. I just wonder if all of those are just drawing from this well.
Yeah, I've heard that there's a video game series called The Driver. Oh, sorry.
Driver. Yes, I remember that.
Driver from the late 90s.
From Ubisoft. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Definite influence there. Interestingly, though, some of the films that are followed in The Driver's wake feel more like video games. The Driver feels very much like a movie, whereas with some subsequent movies that hinge quite prominently around car chase sequences, it feels less visceral. It feels a bit more like you're playing like an old video game.
Just one final point, really. I come to this quite a lot on this podcast. Sometimes when we sit and talk about a film for 20, 30 minutes and we go quite deep on these, we overlook something that you touched on a little bit earlier about how just hugely entertaining a film is. And it is, isn't it? Mm. I mean, it's a ride.
Yeah, absolutely. What more to say other than just you've got to watch the film? I mean, it is really entertaining. It's not a funny film. Like, there's not much to laugh at. But it is gripping. It's entirely gripping from beginning to end. I think it opens with this scene of Ryan O'Neill rising up this sort of industrial lift, and it's like something out of The Terminator. It just looks so cool. All you know about The Driver is that he's good at driving. That's all you know, and that's all you need to know. And that is really the root of why the film is so gripping.
You can now get hold of The Driver on a brand new 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray, which is available from December the 5th from Studio Canal. Before we let you go, Arjun, one thing we do with our guests on this podcast is we ask them to dig into the Studio Canal library to come up with a dream double bill for us. So you've talked to us about The Driver. How are you going to follow that up? What are your two films?
So my first film is Le Cercle Rouge, which is by Jean-Pierre Melville. So this is a Melville double bill that I'm programming in this dream situation.
And is Melville close to your heart?
He's reasonably close to my heart, as close to my heart as someone so kind of cool and glacial in his filmmaking can be. His films are always... You're pretty much always gripping and super influential as well. The Samurai is not part of this double bill, but a key influence on The Driver.
Yeah.
And so if I could do a triple bill, The Samurai would definitely be in there.
You're breaking the rules already. Tell us why you've picked your double bill.
Sure. So Le Cercle Rouge, I think, is quite underseen. I think when it first came out, it was distributed in all these cut versions. It's quite a long film, 2.5 hours. So lengthwise, it goes a very different direction to The Driver. It's very expansive in its length, and it goes into sort of more... I guess there are more plot wrinkles that pad out to that length. But still, it's a very efficient film. Obviously, very long films can also be very lean as well.
Yeah.
This is an example of that. It's a heist film, essentially. And you've got Alain Delon playing a criminal and who teams up with a couple of other crooks to plan an ambitious jewellery heist. And that heist sequence is fantastic. It's so much of it is entirely wordless.
Yeah.
Like some of Hill's films, either films that Hill had written or directed, they have these male leads that don't speak for ages, you know, into the film. I think Ryan O'Neill first says anything like 15 minutes into The Driver. And so this was something that's very much, I think, influenced by people like Melville, who would just go whole sequences, 20, 30 minutes, without really saying anything. Your senses are completely sharpened. You know, there's that whole idea of if one sense is taken away, your others are sharpened. And so if you're not really listening to anyone speak and parsing kind of dialogue, you're just focused on what they're doing with their hands and their bodies and that kind of thing. Not to say sound design isn't important in Le Cercle Rouge or in Melville. He's very meticulous about sound design as well. But anyway, so Le Cercle Rouge, if you like the action scenes, the chase scenes in The Driver, Le Cercle Rouge offers something very different, but still equally compelling in that fantastic heist sequence. And On Fleek would be the second one.
I don't know this one. Tell me about On Fleek.
So this is also Melville. The only reason I choose this one as part of the double bill is because I love Alain Delon, and it's interesting that in other Melville films he's playing a crook, but in On Fleek he's playing a cop.
Yeah.
And so just for that kind of difference, it's interesting to watch. But he doesn't like take a wholly different approach. It's still quite pared back. And both On Fleek and Le Cercle Rouge are very... like, the atmosphere is just fantastic in both these films. In Le Cercle Rouge, you've got like these muddy scenes where it's not necessarily rainy, but you know, it has rained and the ground is all wet and you're plodding through these fields in France and it's all kind of very unappealing and very grey and overcast. And On Fleek, I think the opening 20 minutes or whatever is just torrential rain. There's again a heist sequence in a bank that sort of kicks off the film with all these characters just drenched in rain and you're cutting between these different characters and what they're doing, and it's just so atmospheric. So for Delon and for the atmosphere, On Fleek.
Arjun Sajeep, the investment in a cup of coffee for you was very well rewarded. Thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure to be here.
Now let's turn to some other matters arising in the world of Studio Canal, and there's plenty going on. The big screen first. And the Evil Dead franchise is clambering back out of the earth for a brand new entry in the much-loved horror series, And we've got a confirmed release date for the new film too. It's called Evil Dead Rise, and it's from writer-director Lee Cronin, who was behind the really effective horror The Hole in the Ground. Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell are, of course, executive producing Evil Dead Rise, which will move the action from the woods to the big city. And the date to mark in your diaries? It's April the 21st, 2023, and we're going to be talking about that film a lot more closer to its release. Not before time on this podcast, let's now talk sharks, because filming is now underway on the water-based sharky thriller, Something in the Water, that's shooting in the Dominican Republic. Hayley Easton Street, who was art director on Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens, amongst others, is directing this one, and Kat Clark has penned the script. The film boasts a primarily female cast of rising stars, including Hiftu Kazem, Natalie Mitsun, Nicole Rico Setsuko, and Eloise Shakespeare Hart. Plus, by the sounds of it, a rather sizable sea creature. No release date yet, but we'll keep you posted. No release date either for another film that's gone into production as well. This one's called Wicked Little Letters, and it boasts the powerhouse duo of Jesse Buckley and Olivia Colman at its heart. Johnny Sweet has written the script, and Thea Sharrock is directing, and the story is set in a small UK seaside town in 1920 as letters start arriving that, well, let's just say, they're not on the pleasant side. Again, more on this in a future episode. And then, just a few disc releases to bring to your attention as well. Out now on 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray is a remaster of 1960's The Trial. Now, we've talked Orson Welles before on this show when we examined his wonderful performance in The Third Man. Here, he's behind the camera as well as in front of it. Anthony Perkins co-stars in this adaptation of Franz Kafka's book. And finally in this segment, the 1970s version of King Kong is stomping onto 4K disc just in time for Christmas. It's the 1976 take of the film, starring a young Jeff Bridges and produced by the legendary Dino De Laurentiis. Look out in this one for makeup supremo Rick Baker in the King Kong suit, notably wearing giant contact lenses that left his eye, in the end, slightly scarred, but quite an effect. You can catch King Kong 1976 on 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray from December the 5th.
Put me down!
That's it for this episode of Studio Canal Presents. Next time, well, it's our Christmas special, and we're going to be picking a festive treat or two from the Studio Canal catalogue to explore. There will be absolutely no Christmas cracker jokes, and rest assured, you're still going to be getting socks off Santa. In the meantime, to find out more about Studio Canal Films and the Apple TV and Prime Video channel, you can visit www.studiocanal.co.uk or follow Studio Canal at Studio Canal UK on Twitter, Instagram and TikTok. Now though, I've got to go. Ryan O'Neill's here with my Uber. Thanks for listening. I'll see you back here very soon for the next episode of Studio Canal Presents. Ta-ta for now.